Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist Trent Horn. And today I want to talk about how LGBT ideology ruined the concept of friendship. But before I do that, please be a friend to this channel by liking the video and subscribing to our channel so you don't miss all of our edifying content. All right, so what do I mean? I'm not saying that people with same-sex attraction or sexual identity disorders ruin friendship. I'm talking about the vocal elements within the LGBT movement that want to turn any display of love between people of the same sex into a sexual relationship. What motivated me to talk about this was the online banter about the upcoming animated series Frog and Toad, which is based on a 1978 children's book. Now, I love the Frog and Toad books. My children love them. They enjoy listening to them on Audible. And they're just fun stories about Frog and Toad, exploring the world. But you know, they have this fun quirkiness about them. They have stories about not trying to eat cookies. And so to avoid temptation, they just give the cookies to the birds. Or Frog and Toad rake each other's yards to surprise one another. But when they wake up, the wind messed up both their yards anyways. And they're just these cute stories about the value of friendship and helping each other. Except the internet wants everything to be gay, and Frog and Toad are gay is a trending topic. An article in the Daily Beast says, Frog and Toad are still gay in Apple's new kids show, if you want them to be. It says the following. Though Frog and Toad are simply called friends in the series and in the books, Arnold Lobel, the author, came out to his family as gay in 1974 after the books had been published. In a 2016 interview with The New Yorker, Adrian Lobel called the books the beginning of him coming out. Over the years, Frog and Toad have become gay icons. And it's not just Frog and Toad. People have done this to Bert and Ernie from Sesame Street and Stephen Bucky and Captain America. But I want to be clear, I'm not having a freak out because I can't handle a fictional character identifying as gay. It's about something more foundational. Sex is for the expression of marital love. And marital love is the unique bodily union that only exists between a man and a woman. It's the only love from which a new person to love comes forth. Now, in ancient Greek, there were different words that meant love, like agape, which is sacrificial love, or philios, which is the love of friendship, or eros, romantic love. But in the modern world, everything gets mashed into one word, love. You know, like when people say, love is love, whatever that means. For example, Wesley Hill writes the following in his book, Spiritual Friendship, Finding Love in the Church as a Celibate Gay Christian. The British theologian Elizabeth Stewart, for example, has suggested that a great many lesbian and gay people understand their committed sexual relationships not in terms of marriage or of living together, like unmarried heterosexual couples, but in terms of friendship. Drawing on the insights of queer theory and mindful of the problems attending a simple transfer of heterosexual norms and expectations to gay relationships, Stewart and others look to friendship, with its voluntary, non-hierarchical bonds of affection, as a potentially fruitful model for understanding the significance of erotic same-sex partnerships. The result may be, as sociologist Peter Nardi has expressed it, that gay and lesbian people have elevated friendship to an importance perhaps not matched by any other group. And friendship, in this view, comes to entail sexual expression. Hill tries to argue as a celibate, self-identified gay Christian that non-sexual friendship should be what LGBT persons strive for as an expression of their gay identity. But if sexual attraction is always a part of your identity, then you can't just be friends with each other, for the same reason men and women can't just be friends. There's always a sexual tension that prevents someone from being vulnerable and honest with the other person. One reason that incest is wrong, among other reasons, is that God created familial relationships so that there would be no moral possibility of sex. That's why we rightly call it an abusive situation if a young woman legitimately wonders if her father wants to have sex with her. But it's not an abusive situation if she simply wonders the same thing about a male coworker. If you never had a safe space to be honest with a person and not worry about whether they want to have sex with you, you'd go insane. But LGBT ideology only works if sex is not for uniting men and women as a one-flesh union in a way so that it's distorted or perverted if it's sought outside that context. For example, the stomach is for digesting food. So if we choose to throw up food simply because we don't want the calories, we pervert the digestive process. In that case, the physical makeup of our bodies tells us what is and isn't rightly ordered. But if we completely reject the idea that our physical bodies are one sign that tell us when sex is and isn't appropriate with someone else, then we have to let something else tell us what is appropriate, like emotional commitment. But while physical sexual compatibility is something you only find in opposite sex relationships, and so if you don't want to worry about that, you can pursue a same-sex friendship, emotional commitment is something in all friendships. But if emotional commitment is the primary guide to let us know when sex is appropriate, then suddenly sex is now on the table for nearly all of our relationships, and there's few ways to avoid that tension. If sex is just a way to show that you have the deepest level of intimacy with someone in general, then it becomes almost impossible to find deep, non-sexual levels of intimacy with another person. There's always the nagging question of whether sexual behavior should accompany this intense emotional intimacy. Instead of sex being reserved as the most complete expression of one type of love, eros between a man and a woman that culminates in a one-flesh union, sex becomes just the deepest expression of a much more generic love, the love of friendship. But then friendship loses the lack of sexual tension that makes it comfortable in the first place. You can see this collapsing of friendship and romance in scripture studies, like LGBT revisionist theologians who say Jonathan and David had a gay relationship in the Old Testament. That was a thesis pioneered in Tom Horner's 1978 book, Jonathan Loved David, and then adopted by the revisionist scholar John Boswell. So first, a biblical recap. After David defeated Goliath, he established a strong friendship with Jonathan, the son of King Saul. David is placed as a leader over Israel's army, but King Saul is jealous of the people's love of David. The first book of Samuel puts it this way. When David returned from slaying the Philistine, the women came out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul with timbrels, with songs of joy, and with instruments of music. And the women sang to one another as they made merry. Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s. And Saul was very angry, and this saying displeased him. He said, "They have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed thousands. And what more can he have but the kingdom?" And Saul eyed David from that day on. Now, fortunately, Jonathan warned David about his father's plans to kill him, because Jonathan and David had already formed a covenant with each other, but not a marriage covenant. Here's the beginning of 1 Samuel 18. When he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. And Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Saul took him that day and would not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was upon him and gave it to David, and his armor, and even his sword, and his bow, and his girdle. And David went out and was successful wherever Saul sent him, so that Saul set him over the men of war. And this was good in the sight of all the people, and also in the sight of Saul's servants. At the end of 1 Samuel, Saul and Jonathan die at the Battle of Mount Gilboa. And David reflects on this in 2 Samuel chapter 1, where he says, "How are the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle? Jonathan lies slain upon thy high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant have you been to me. Your love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women." David does not mean sexual behavior with Jonathan was more pleasurable than sexual behavior with women. What he means is that David had deeper levels of intimacy in the philios, or brotherly love, he had with Jonathan than the erotic love he had with his many, many wives. The language about being knit to the soul and stripping robes is also ancient kinship language related to familial love, not sexual love. Biblical scholar Robert Gagnon puts it this way. The two now relate as brothers, not as a romantic couple. Mention of the fact that Jonathan's soul was bound to David's soul no more expresses erotic love than do the words of Judah to Joseph in Genesis 44. If Judah returns to his father Jacob without Benjamin, Jacob will die because his, Jacob's soul, is bound up with Benjamin's soul. The verb kasar usually refers to a binding together of people for political purposes. In effect, Jonathan is assuring David that he has hitched his fortunes to those of David, politically and emotionally. The language of love is typical between an overlord and vassals, or between two political rulers of roughly equal power. For example, future vassals of the Assyrian king Ashurbanipal were instructed, "You must love him as yourselves." King Hiram of Tyre is described as a lover or friend of David's. Finally, I need to talk about Catholics who have same-sex attraction and don't engage in sexual behavior outside of marriage, but still believe they can have spiritual friendships with people of the same sex they're attracted to. There's a great article in First Things from March of 2023 by Bethel McGrew that covers this. It's called How the Side B Project Failed. To provide some backstory, among Christians who identify as being gay, there are two groups: the side A Christians, who think homosexuality is not a sin, and the side B Christians, who think it is a sin, and so they choose to live chastely. The failure is about those side B Christians who also want to have what seem like gay relationships, but without sexual relations. It seems like playing with fire and a huge source of temptation. One of them is in the Catholic world is Eve Tushnet, who wrote the book Gay and Catholic back in 2014. In a blog post published in January of this year, Tushnet described a relationship she has with another woman, saying this: "If you see us out and about, including at Mass, you'll likely guess that we are a lesbian couple. We are. We are also learning to live more deeply in harmony with our shared Catholic faith, the bedrock of our lives and our love." Remember, they say that they're committed to chastity, so presumably they aren't engaging in sexual immorality. But McGrew notes that, quote, "Various side B writers have rejected the idea that homosexual temptation is uniquely disordered." In his 2017 book, All But Invisible, Revoice founder Nate Collins argued that the word disordered should apply equally to any sexual attraction outside monogamous male-female marriage. That same year, future Revoice collaborator Gregory Coles published his memoir, Single Gay Christian, in which he speculated that his homosexual proclivity was not even a result of the fall. Meanwhile, Hill, Belgao, and Tushnet all consistently normalized certain manifestations of same-sex desire, blurring the lines between proto-romance and spiritual friendship. I'm very skeptical of the spiritual friendship movement's ability to promote chaste relationships between self-identified gay and lesbian people who also call themselves couples. It just seems like playing with fire. It would be like a married man having a female friend he's attracted to, who he jokingly calls his work wife. The two of them may say they have a deep platonic relationship, just like the man has with his other male coworkers. But ultimately, temptation or despair will get the better of those two. That's why the Catechism says this: homosexual persons are called to chastity by the virtues of self-mastery that teach them inner freedom, at times by the support of disinterested friendship, by prayer and sacramental grace. They can and should gradually and resolutely approach Christian perfection, paragraph 2359. Note the wording of disinterested friendship. I understand it can be hard to be someone who has same-sex attraction and to find authentic friendship. If you're a self-identified gay man, then you may be attracted to male friends, and female friends may be attracted to you. It is a difficult cross to bear, but the answer is not to dump the cross and just try to have deeply emotional friendships with people we are attracted to and refer to one another as being part of a couple. If the attraction can never be licitly consummated, you're playing with fire. The answer is to form deep friendships without couple language. The answer is to value the deep love of friendship without always wanting that love to become sexual, as the modern world seems to always propose. It's to acknowledge the beauty of how two men or two women best exemplify the love of friendship, that unique love, by having sex never enter the equation. Not because they aren't emotionally compatible with each other, but because they aren't biologically compatible right from the start. There's a very morally offensive movie that's one of my favorites. Sorry. It's called Superbad. It's about, in one sense, two teenage boys, played by Michael Cera and Jonah Hill, trying to have sex with their crushes at a party at the end of the school year. But in a deeper sense, it's about the far more intimate non-sexual love of their own friendship that they have, And the tragedy in that this relationship is probably going to end because they did not get into the same college. At the end of the movie, after a night of drunken escapades, the two boys apologize for being mean to each other, and falling asleep in separate sleeping bags, they say, "I love you, and I'm not even embarrassed to say it." And Michael Cera's character says in response, "I'm not embarrassed. Why don't we say that every day? Why don't we say it more often?" And what makes the scene so sweet is that the whole movie has been about trying to get sex or get alcohol so girls will be more likely to have sex. But here, there's just emotional commitment, deep intimacy, without sexual tension. But if LGBT ideology says that emotional commitment just is the foundation of sexual commitment, then the specter of sex always hangs over what should just be the unique good of disinterested friendship. So I hope this all was helpful to you guys. And yeah, I just hope that you have a very blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.